to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Morning. Many study. So I want to try to talk about something that is impossible to talk about. So let's talk about it. It comes up all the time. It came up in the study group the other night. Jody asked, well, we're supposed to not see differences, and we're supposed to live in emptiness and so on. And yet, what about introspection? What about paying attention to the, I'm going to say quality of my words and deeds? And what about asking myself, is this right livelihood? What about checking in with myself about any particular word or deed? And, you know, for me, sometimes the more glib answer is, well, it isn't saying you should be stupid. And I often say, practice in the relative world with the mind of emptiness. And I think that's true. But how do we understand these admonitions from the wisdom, emptiness teachings, which is what Prajnaparamita is, the perfection of wisdom, the wisdom that's gone beyond, great wisdom beyond wisdom, Heart Sutra. And I know those teachings are not telling us that a bodhisattva does not live in the world. They're not saying that. Bodhisattvas live all over, in all kinds of places in the world. And there are stories about great bodhisattvas. Avalokiteshvara spent the practice period in the brothels. And Manjushri was going to smack him down when he returned to the group at the end of the practice period. And Buddha said, no, he's been doing bodhisattva work. And there are koans, wonderful koans that say things like, you know, if I were living in the absolute, you couldn't hear me. And I couldn't talk. So you can't completely occupy that. There's a story of the bodhisattva went out in a boat and with a bunch of other people, and a sea pirate comes and says, I don't know, I'm going to take one of you. I need an oarsman. And Buddha says, you are not my disciple. If you say, take me, I'll go. A bodhisattva doesn't see distinctions like that, they say. The bodhisattva just goes. Yet even in just going, you're making a choice, you're making a distinction, you're going. You're not sitting there paralyzed by fear like everybody else in the boat. I deeply know that this teaching is true and valid and useful. I deeply know that it's something to be practiced. And shared, at least in the sense of being less self-protective and less self-involved and less self-clinging and less, all the no's of the Heart Sutra, less all those things. Living in the yes of the Heart Sutra. We talked about that in the class. Some people said the Heart Sutra is nothing but yeses. And I've been sort of enjoying that ever since. And then, since then. Every no in there is an opportunity to let go of your clinging a little bit more. And each time you let go of it a little bit more, that's a yes. That's an invitation. But how do we how do I explain this? And maybe I just don't. I don't know. Maybe that's the answer, is that I don't explain it. I just say, sit more zazen. And that's largely true. I'm not sure that I'm allowed to just say that, because I'm supposed to. there's a book, one of Katagiri's books. The first one is Returning to Silence, and the second one is, the title is, You Have to Say Something. So I'm supposed to say something. Ultimately, maybe, though, that my and our job is to understand this practice of emptiness, actually this practice beyond emptiness, as deeply as we're capable of doing, to allow it to permeate our bones and our marrow. And as it perfumes, as the classic word is, as it perfumes our practice, as it perfumes our life, then it shows and it encourages other people. And maybe that's how we teach it. By allowing this wisdom beyond wisdom to permeate our lives and to arouse Bodhi mind, arouse wisdom mind, arouse way-seeking mind, so that we continue to, the phrase that came to me was drive it deeper. Driving it seems maybe not quite the right image, but allow it to permeate more completely. In the Diamond Sutra, it says over and over again, you know, like, if I gave heaps of the seven precious things, which are like coral and lapis lazuli and pearls and gold, heaps of these things to the Buddhas, would I acquire great merit, Subhuti? And Subhuti says, yes, Lord, you would acquire great merit. And then Buddha says, but incalculably greater, greater as many times as there are grains of sands in the river Ganges, is the merit for a person who memorizes four stanzas from this sutra and preaches it to others. Pretty good, huh? But also, notice it says preaches. Now, I don't know what the word is in Sanskrit. But I'd rather say practices and demonstrates it to others. Doesn't mean you should never talk about emptiness or zazen. I don't think that, well, you tell me what you think of this. I started to say, I don't think that anybody gets attracted to the zazen by your talking to them about it. I'm not sure that's literally true. But they must, I think it's still true that they must have some inclination towards it that can be awakened, and that what you can do is set the spark or offer the opportunity, or as I've been saying, show them, not on purpose, but show them just by how you live your life and how you are in the world, show them the fruits of your practice. I've told you before about my friend Pam Weiss at Green Gulch and Tassajara. She used to say, when she, you know, when some we were studying something new, she used to say, "What's the point?" She talked about it. She didn't always say it out loud, though she often did, but she always said it to herself, "What's the point?" And I say that to people that are starting to lecture, to keep asking yourself, what's the point? What am I trying to say here? And my point is that it's hard to talk about this. And it's useful to struggle with that. It's useful to struggle with, well, what is this emptiness, this going beyond in my life? How do I know it matters? And can I, for me, I know it matters. I don't have the slightest question about it. But how do I talk about it? How do I share that with others? How do I encourage people? And how do I open further to it? I really kind of like drive it deeper in my life, but I don't like that. It stinks of insisting, that phrase. But there is some sense in which we, you know, we develop the intention to practice and the vow of practice. And sometimes we do need to exercise a little discipline with ourselves, if only to stop obsessing about something in zazen, say, and drop it and come back to the breath. That's a driving. I was started looking yesterday at this book, which I commend to you, the Diamond Sutra. It's an analysis and a translation by Musan. When I started making notes for this talk, I wrote that for a title. I said, what are we doing here? What are we doing? There is a wonderful sort of contrast to help us think about it, I suppose. In the Heart Sutra, you know, it says, no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, and so on. All those no's, no self, no self. And Prajnaparamita is about no self. We talked a lot on Thursday about no self, not even seeing a distinction. And at the same time, there's a story about our Chinese founder, Zhongshan. When he was a kid in school in China in the early CEs, or maybe around 800. Anyway, he was a kid and they were reciting the Heart Sutra in school. And when they finished, he said, but I have eyes and I have a nose. And his teacher realized that he was somebody who had potential and sent him off to study with a Zen teacher. So what was so great about that? I mean, you could say, he was just being a resistant little jerk. I have eyes. Yeah, I know you have eyes. That's kind of not the point, kid. You know, could have said that. What about thinking about my life? My life. Don't do it. I could say that. Just sit. Was it Emerson? Who was it that said, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living? That's
Socrates.
What?
Socrates through Plato.
Okay. Literally that? Because I think it's more recent than that, but maybe not.
No, it definitely is that ancient.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, he certainly did. Yeah, well, that's not fine. So much the better. So, how do we live with this? What was Dongshan expressing at that point? I think he was expressing demonstrating, not on purpose, I don't think, but demonstrating that it got through to his ego. In other words, that it really touched him in some way, and he took it seriously in some way, that it wasn't just a bunch of words people recite the Pledge of Allegiance or something. I don't know, I wasn't there, but that's how I understand it. And then he had to, wrestle with that and a lot of other things. He wrestled a lot with the idea of inanimate objects preaching the Dharma. This is from the, what I'm about to read is from the Diamond Sutra. I want to say, if the assembly here were not seasoned Zen students, this lecture would sound very different. So I don't know how it would be. I want to have it posted, but I don't know how it would be for folks because they feel pretty disjointed. But I know that I am turning the facets of a ball that you're all familiar with. And I hope that you wonder about it too. So this is a Buddha speaking, Shibuti. In the practice of generosity, a bodhisattva should be unsupported, unsupported. He or she should practice generosity without regard to sight, sound, touch, flavor, smell, or any thought that arises in it. Subhuti, thus should a bodhisattva practice generosity without being supported by any notion of a sign. Any notion of a thing or a name. Why? When a bodhisattva practices generosity without being supported by any notion of a sign, her or his merit will be beyond conception. Subhuti, what do you think? Can you measure the space extending eastward? No, world-honored one, I cannot. Shibuti, can you measure the space extending towards the south or west or north or above or below? No, world-honored one, I cannot. Shibuti, so it is with the merit of a bodhisattva who practices generosity without cherishing any notion of a sign. It is beyond measure, like space, Shibuti. A bodhisattva should persevere one-pointedly in this instruction. Without being supported, generosity without being supported, without any notion of a sign. Just do it. And that empty generosity is worthy of incalculable merit. No merit. I think we have to just practice it. And it is, just sit, zazen. Just sit there and keep letting go and letting go and letting go and letting go. And occasionally, actually letting go. And finding, experiencing, sinking into the great Dharma fountain, the great womb of the Buddha, in which there's constant refreshment. It's not a bank that we put deposits in. Because that's too literal. However, I guess you could kind of think of it that way. That all that letting go, all that zazen is refreshing our Dharma. Oh, I don't like any of the words that are coming up. Refreshing our Dharma account. Its ability, or just maybe refreshing our Dharma connection, deepening our Dharma insight. But there is some sense, I think, of refreshing. When you sit Zazen, there's a refreshment to it. And sometimes you can really feel it. You need to. You need a one-day sitting. You need a sesshin. Other times it's not, doesn't feel so urgent, but you know, I'm sure. So many of you have told me over the years, so many people, I stopped sitting for a week or two, and I really felt it. I felt how it changed, how my life changed, and I could see that I needed to sit. Or, I've been sitting twice a day, and I can really feel the difference. That's wisdom beyond wisdom. That's wisdom. You know it. You know it in your bones. And, you know, you could talk about it in words, but it isn't about words. It's beyond words. And it's where form and emptiness meet. Remember, on Thursday, we read about, you know, don't get stuck either place. So I think that's plenty from me for now. I hope that I have troubled you. Wait, do you have any comments or questions or insights? Kelly and then Steve.
I was just rolling around the idea of the kid saying, well, I have a nose and I have eyes and ears. And I was thinking about that, and really, isn't that the point, though? Because I was like, what is the point of the sutra negating all of these things unless I have been pretty convinced for a while that they exist? Mm-hmm. I was like, maybe that's a first step that I haven't even taken yet, is that I do believe that these things exist, and the sutra that I love is telling me to negate them.
Yes, I think so. That's a good way of saying it. I think that I was saying that, but I think that's a better way of saying it anyway. But yes, I think that his, you know, that some, it got to him in some way.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
at least he was thinking about it.
Yeah.
which you did say, it's not like just standing there saying the Pledge of Allegiance, which we all, many of us did as kids and didn't think twice about it.
That's right. Well, yeah, I don't know why, but we used to listen sometimes. I mean, not being theists in my family at all, we used to listen to the Rosary Hour, which we didn't listen to it for a huge long time. But, you know, it's just these people saying, Holy Mary, Mother of God, blessed art thou among women, blessed is the fruit of thy Jesus, fruit of thy womb, Jesus, amen, Holy Mary, Mother of God.
Yeah.
And the way they said, well, it was meditative, the way they said it. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, he didn't have the sense that the words meant much to him. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe they did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve?
Yes, so I like the image of generosity as completely unsupported, and it brings up yet again, that to me it seems like it's pushing on the ego. That because if you take it literally instead of poetically, which one is inclined to do when we're protecting our egos, it sort of like says, be completely generous, give everything you have to others. And it sets up this idea of generosity, generally sets up the idea of yourself and others. And yet it's saying be completely unsupported. Don't consider the signs, words, and concepts. Sort of like saying don't consider self and others, and be so generous that you're like the you're limitless. It's like the sky above and on all sides and underneath you are limitless. And then it comes back and says, and you get limitless merit. Wait, isn't that me getting the merit? But it's limitless. And I actually think that's very helpful to have that interplay that just sort of pushes you, hey, there's something in it for you. But then if you like sort of sit with it a little bit, you see there's actually nothing for you. Another simpler image that I've always liked about generosity is be generous like the when we're called on to be generous like a great shade tree gives its shade to everyone underneath it without thinking about, hey, I'm being a generous tree, I've got so much shade, and gives its leaves to fertilize the ground without thinking of, you know, what it's doing, or that, oh, I had these leaves and I'm sacrificing them. You know, it's just generous. So those are my kind of random thoughts on that, but I really like it. And the way it is.
Well, and when you jumped in front of that bully, that was generous, and it was unsupported. You know, you just did it, and as I don't think it's necessarily about, you know, giving away everything you own, but it's about those gestures. Or those actions, I guess, without regard for consequences or getting something back or any of that kind of stuff. And it is a wonderful, unsupported, without any notion of a sign. Just do it. And I think I make jokes about the notion of merit because a bodhisattva isn't supposed to care about merit, and a bodhisattva turns the merit over. And that's when we can't, we bodhisattvas, we always dedicate the merit to others, right? Because when you do something really, really generous, then you acquire immeasurable merit. Well, now what do you do? But I wouldn't worry about it, really. I mean, I used to joke about I should do something really unskillful and unkind or something so as to get rid of the merit. That's silly.
I think I didn't mean to say give away everything you own so much as the implication of complete generosity, so much as to completely give away the sense of self.
Yeah. Dana and then Kate.
I would just have a couple thoughts. The first thing was how this no eyes, no ears, no nose, that was in my head when I received this letter that I would have normally been really angry, but it helped me. It came to me, it wasn't, I guess, Alaya, like you say, was in there. And it kind of dropped away myself to where I could just kind of read this letter from someone and not be so hooked up in it. It was kind of like a tapped into compassion in a way, even though it kind of wore off after a while. But the impact of this judgmental kind of rigid letter wasn't there right off the bat, and so I consider that, I think, a fruit of practice maybe. And then this week we had something happen in our family. The lady who always made this cap for me and her husband who made these, she's my mother-in-law. She fell and broke both of her wrists. Mm-hmm. So she literally has no hands suddenly. And so this is her life, making these beautiful things with her hands. And her husband, they have been together for so many years. They are both of their hands. And he's now feeding her, toileting her, learning to braid her hair, which he says is much harder than digging a ditch. He'd rather dig a ditch than fix her hair. But it's just been kind of this selflessness between them and to witness, and it's such a beautiful conversation to have them on the phone and hear the example of their relationship. There's no questioning or no feeling on his part how he feels about taking her to the toilet and dealing with all of the things. Oh, he's buying her bidet, which is good. All the things about women he never knew. But mostly the example of their love and devotion as a selfless, lifelong journey for my husband and I has been beautiful to watch and witness. And it caused us to look at each other and realize, hey, this is us too. You know, this is being married too. This, so there's no separation in this kind of awareness growing. No eyes, no ears, no nose. It's spiritual, and it's also can be very real.
You know, when I butter my toast in the morning, I often think about the people that sliced my bread and buttered my toast when I couldn't. You know? It's very moving. Kate?
Yeah, I was, I often think about how, you know, we have to talk about it, even though you can't really talk about it. But part of what's so appealing to me is, for me, what's really been important is that it's not intellectual. It's not something I understand just intellectually or only. What has been most meaningful is to understand it. And the best way I can think to say it, it's an embodied practice. Like you said, I know something, but it's not, I know it like I memorized my multiplication tables. It's not that kind of knowing, you know, which is useful. And I can't do it anymore because I'm too dependent on my phone. But then... No eyes, no ear. I mean, I think of it as embodied, and then no eyes, no ears, no nose, which I'm not sure how to hold those two things. And but I do know, like Dana said, I mean, in my walking around in the world day to day, my awareness is changed in some way. I notice particularly when I'm challenged emotionally with someone's opinion that is different than mine, or someone's angry. I don't mind so much when I'm angry. It feels kind of good, you know, it's energizing. But when somebody's angry at me, oh my God, that's much more difficult for me to be present with. So, but I do notice there's something different operating in me as I think a result of my sitting each day. I don't respond in the same way. And So I don't know. And I know that it wasn't just the teachings that drew me. It was watching people, you know. I mean, I think of you, Mary, when I first came to the Zendo. And I think of, I'm going to cry. I think of Steve Stuckey, his presence communicated something. He had some and it doesn't have to be teachers either. I mean, so it's like pointing at the moon, you know. It's not the moon, but it's also been useful for me to take stock, like Jody would, and ask myself, you know, what is my vow? What does it mean to live by vow? Why do I sit on that cushion? There's no real answers, but the questioning is useful for me. And yeah, that's it.
Anybody have anything else to say? So,
beings are numberless. I vow to save them, to lose.